Good morning, everybody. So I've been thinking a lot about impermanence, and it's everywhere. The unexpected. In particular, I've just been very aware, as I'm sure many of you have, of an apparently increasing level of suffering among our children, in our own lives, feeling more rattled, feeling oftentimes more angry and upset, and hearing about other people who are angry and upset. So I turn to my practice and I say, what can I do for myself and other beings? What's right action here? And being that I've practiced for 20 years, the first place I look is to the Buddha's instructions for practice. And at the core of that instruction, we have, of course, the Four Noble Truths. The truth of dukkha, which includes suffering, but also dissatisfaction, discontentment, this human life, where things change without us wanting to, them to, where people die, including us. And then we have the truth of the path of non-suffering. Yes, there is a way to live without suffering. It is possible for each and every one of us. And then the offering of the Eightfold Path. So the title of my talk this morning is a reflection of some of what I've been looking at, because one of the key discoveries of the truth of suffering is that there really is no independent, substantial self. And that's an appealing idea, sort of. Right? It's like, what does that look like? What does a world without me look like? Because we have the Buddha's teaching that this is not I, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Whatever is arising. So the experience of this and practicing with it and being able to see it and then just being able to actually tolerate it is a pretty big part of practice. It's a pretty radical change when we can realize that my life isn't personal. So what does that look like? So the first encouragement is to focus on what's actually the experience, what's actually happening. In our meditation, oftentimes, we focus on staying with our object. And oftentimes we come to meditation as with the hope that it will dissolve our suffering. It will get rid of something we don't like. And that actually isn't the most useful instruction that the Buddha has given us. I mean, those are things that we can do and they can be helpful. But really, the focus of our meditation needs to be looking at how did I arise? Where did this idea of a me, which is so troublesome to us as we take in the experiences of this universe, how did that arise? And the core of that question really is something that's called dependent origination. Because of that, this. That everything is a series, really, of moments. It's not a connected series. We've seen some of you Bjarkren's chart. So there's, this is the Dharma moment. This is the Dharma position. And that happens continuously at about the speed of light. So even if we say, okay, the Buddha seemed to have a lot going for him, maybe I should just take this on faith, just keeping track of it's not easy. This is also known as the Wheel of Samsara, and this is also known as the 12 links of causation. So I want to spend some time on the 12 links of causation. Most of them can be seen by most of us at some point during a meditation. This isn't a magical thing, but it's different. It's a different than what we think we'll see when we look at a moment. So it's good to have an idea about what the Buddha saw, without trying to create it, to help us basically know what we're looking for, what we should be paying attention to. So the power of this dependent origination is captured in this quote. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. So this is an indication from the Buddha that there's a lot of power in this particular seeing. This is how this I and our life and our experience arises and disappears. And when we see that there really isn't an I there, and we have to directly experience it before it has some credibility for us, when we see that, then it's just not the same experience as when we take it personally. Now, let's just keep going. And at the end, we can come back to this impersonal thing. I found that as I was preparing this talk, I kept getting irked by that word, impersonal. It's like, that just doesn't sound like the life I want. I want a personal life. So right there, we get to see where I starts. So the Buddha said that in order for us to penetrate the depth of the truth of suffering, and he was very clear that there was a lot of depth and it took some training to be able to see it deeply, but that it was a key in a lock to right view and right thought. And we've all had experiences where all of a sudden something we thought was one way, we get some new information, maybe a point of view, maybe somebody else sharing their feelings, and all of a sudden we see it differently and our response to it is differently. Last one. So he spells it out for us. He said, we need to understand the origination of me and my, the disappearance of me and my, the gratification, which is really the craving and the clinging part. So in other words, what makes it attractive to grasp and cling? The dangers of the personal point of view. So what I was just exhibiting earlier was a lack of appreciation for the dangers of the personal point of view when I said, but I don't want my life to be impersonal. It's like, do I really know what I'm saying there? Can I appreciate the dangers? So we're going to get into some of the dangers. And the escape from this compelling conviction of I. We need to see all of those aspects to fully appreciate and understand the 12 links of causation and how I arises. I really like this chart. So these are the 12 links. And it's important to understand that a big chunk of them are impersonal, and some of them are quite hard to see. And it's imperative to understand that some of them are personal. Because the things that are on the impersonal side are not really a choice. They happen. Life happens. On the personal side, this is where suffering arises. This is where training the mind helps us to have a choice, at least about doing something differently. Acting in a different way, thinking in a different way, speaking in a different way. Without that choice, this just continues as it has been planted. So let's just go through these. I don't think they're totally new to a lot of people, but it helps to remember about them. So ignorance is how we arrive upon birth. The human is not aware of this point of view, this dependent origination view that the Buddha discovered and shares with us. Formations and consciousness are really two aspects of, they're kind of a potential. Let me look at my notes so that I can be a little clearer about that. So formations basically are any action of body, speech, and mind. It's really a kind of karmic energy. So there's been something in the past that upon which this is based. So this arises because a seed of volition. It might be will, it might be anger, it might be a particular act, it might be speech. So those, the formations really are kind of the storehouse consciousness. It's like the basement, it's the attic, it's where all those things that go out of our conscious life are germinating. You know, it's like what's in a fallow field. We don't know, but there's stuff happening. So that's formations. It's got the potential that will reveal itself as other things are added to the mix. So consciousness is a kind of potential. It's not very easy to see in its generic form, but it combines really with either the existence of thoughts and sounds. This is what mentality and materiality is. And then the six sense doors. So we say there's the eye, the sight, and then eye consciousness, which together are the conditions for contact to be established. So contact is probably the first place when we're meditating that we can see something that we may not be all that attuned to. It's happening all the time, right? There's the sort of the organ, there's the consciousness, and then there's the, you know, smells and sights and sounds and tastes that are all kind of out there. But then when they come together, we can see, oh, I'm hearing something, or hearing. The next thing is feeling, which is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. So up to that point, we don't get to vote. This is just happening. Whatever that have happened in the past will manifest and get us to, at the speed of light, okay? That was like, I don't know, a billion or so in one snap of a finger. But in meditation, actually, we can see some of this. We can have a calm enough mind so that we can actually catch an occasional contact, so that we have some sense. So just take a minute right now, close your eyes, and just sit quietly and notice the contacts. Notice things happening. And if you can, maybe you can catch a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant. It's almost like just a leaning in, a leaning out, or no particular action. Now, feeling is something. Let's say we're in meditation, or maybe we're in traffic, and a person speeds up and passes in front of us. All right? Unpleasant. And at that point, craving kicks in. It always manifests as tension or tightness. Unpleasant. Or even joy. There's a certain body reaction to it. That's the mind of, I don't like this. Or, oh, I like this. So that's where things start sucking us in. And then we start looking at why we don't like it or why we do like it. So there's stories there where we get involved with it. So maybe there's a smell of coffee coming out of Dun Brothers as you pass. It's like, oh, right? And it's like, I really should stop in. Oh, I don't really have time. You know, so there's this whole process that goes on. It says, oh, but, you know, they've got pumpkin spice now, you know, or something like that, right? Really, I ought to treat myself. I've been having a hard day, okay? So that's where clinging happens. And we have this kind of library, our own personal library, of habitual tendencies. And some of them came with us when we were born. Others of them have arisen and been part of our experience as we've lived in this human body. So those are automatic. Sometimes we can spot them, especially if we've trained the mind a little bit, we can catch them. But oftentimes, they're off and running. By the time we've gotten through craving and clinging, we're in there, the wallet's out, we're in line in the Dun Brothers. Or we're honking our horn, or, you know, I don't know how many of you do. I'm often dismayed even minutes, hours, days after I've said something, and I suddenly realize, where did that come from? Didn't I say I wasn't going to do that? Or, I won't go into the details. I think we all kind of have some familiarity with our habitual tendencies. All right. And then as the habitual tendencies sort of get energized, because that's what's happening on this wheel, is things are speeding up and the energy is getting stronger. And when it gets strong enough, ta-da! We get the birth of action, either in the form of thought, speech, or some act of, you know, physical act of the body. And then, whether it's a moment or what we call our whole life, there's the impermanence part, the decline, the decay, and the disappearance. So it's the ones in red that can really benefit from this process of training the mind. It is possible to, hold on a second. I might need to go to the next page. Oh, good. Two things can happen. So we can react. And you notice a little dash there. Essentially, that lays down a logging road in the forest of our existence, right? And We go over it, and, you know, it's like the deer paths or something like that, right? We just, every time we're caught in a particular habit pattern and that action gets reacted, then that lays down a little more power and pattern. There's a little more automata. So anybody who's tried to quit, like, smoking, or in my case, remember to lock the back door, you know, where it's happening, or, you know, remember to lock the door with the key instead of just locking the inside and closing the door and then forgetting that your keys are inside, you know. And usually that happens because I'm not necessarily present. It's just, it just takes over and it happens, right? And the speed of light part is rather important because that's how we get stuck on the wheel of samsara. It's happening so fast. The second choice is a trained mind. So first we hear about these things happening, like we are today. And then, having heard about them, we kind of go, oh, that's what they were talking about. Sometimes when we're in our meditation, we'll be able to see that. And oftentimes that can happen to people that just come to introduction to meditation for the first time. You take them through a body scan and all of a sudden it's like, I have a whole different experience. At the prison where I do work, we hold a tea ceremony once a year. And we serve tea and cookies, if they let us. And we eat and drink in silence. And when we ask people how that was, it is common for them to say, wow, I never took that in. I've never eaten in that way. And it was different. And I noticed different things. So that can happen the first time you sit down in meditation. And of course, you don't necessarily have to meditate, as one of my abbesses reminded me. There are perfectly wonderful people that never meditate. But the Buddha said, basically, that'll help things a lot. It helps you see what's happening. And then that gives you an opportunity, that mindfulness, seeing how things work, gives us the opportunity to choose an impersonal response. So instead of reacting, there's some consideration first. And this begins to release and relax the tension of craving. The relax part is very, very important because that's the experience of cessation of suffering. If we're not there for the relaxed part, and a lot of times when I meditate, when I realize that I'm off someplace beside here, my trained reaction now is to leap back to my meditation object. And usually there's a little soupçon of irritation, or maybe there's some inner critic, or maybe if I'm a little calmer, I just come back. But I don't necessarily relax that tension. And that's actually a quite physical thing. There's a like a membrane around the brain. It's something called the meninges. And it basically winds all the way down the spinal cord. So the relax is actually the physical cessation of the tension that automatically goes with craving. So we can kind of work that in a couple of different ways. It's helpful to see that. So this is, I think, part of what I've already been through, but let's go through it again. With feeling as a condition. So we start with contact, which is kind of like putting the key in the ignition of a car. All right, so far nothing's happened, but there's contact. Right? Something could happen. Feeling is the part where we move into the I. It's unpleasant or it's pleasant. When I like it or I, you know, so it's like Who's feeling this? I am. Who doesn't like this? I don't. All right? When that's happening, there we are in craving. And that's where that tension first comes. And even just as, you know, as I talk through this, you can probably call up a body memory of that tension. But it's always there. And the more subtle our meditation gets and the calmer we get, the more able we are to actually see how much tension there is in the body. Oftentimes we're walking around with a tremendous amount of tension that we're not at all aware of. So I gets involved with, I don't like stories, experiences, rememberings, and that tightness increases and it becomes involved, right? That's the part where we're starting. So at this point, we are in our car. We're at the point where the car has jerked into motion, right? We've kind of put it into drive at this point. And then it starts accelerating. So the storehouse gets involved of our habitual reactions, and bada bing, there's a reaction before really we know what we're doing. So this relaxing, when we notice that the tension comes up, the release and the relax in meditation, but also as we go through the day, is a crucial part of what we can do to help ourselves have a less personal relationship to our life. That doesn't sound like a good thing, but wait, just wait. So as we kind of move through the gears, eventually, essentially, we're rolling down the highway in our car. And depending on the habitual reaction, our library, we have some ability to choose the speed for that. We have some ability to choose the pace for that. And eventually, we run out of gas, right? And that particular event disappears. Now this, of course, is the slow motion version of what's happening at the speed of light. So this eye can see the links. It's possible pretty readily for us to be able to see seven of those links. So the seven that we're able to relatively easily pick up in meditation especially, but even just waiting for the bus, contact, so, oh, sound, I'm seeing, I'm hearing, I'm feeling. Feeling, it's pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. And then we get onto the personal part of the ear. I don't like it. It's too cold. I wish it wasn't spring. That's clinging. Then we get into a habitual tension. Suddenly I'm talking about it and I'm complaining. And then after habitual, let me go back to my links here. What happens after habitual? Oh, the birth of action. So it may manifest as a complaint, or it may manifest as sadness or, you know, unhappiness or depression or joy or romantic love. But it's on its way, and then it has to play out. And sometimes it doesn't fully play out. Sometimes all the conditions for its full arising, decay, and death can take a long time. So this isn't necessarily something that's going to come to fruition and go through the whole cycle in just this moment. It can show up years later, or it's like it was unfinished business, like an unfinished symphony.
So birth of action can be just a feeling? Is
that what you just said? No, birth of action is going to be a thought. It's going to be verbal, something I say, or it's going to be a physical action. But conditions for that include a feeling. That's the chain of choice, really, the choice part of the 12 links. It's also highly related to suffering. So once we kind of are onto these, particularly these seven links that we can see in meditation, then we can begin to notice how suffering arises within one event in life at a time. So this is a little bit the mindfulness practice that we publish monthly. It's like, try noticing this. And we begin to see, oh, that's oh, I just noticed this contact thing. You know, I heard a bird, and now I'm seeing it unfold. So the important point about this is we're not helpless if we understand how this works. If we're ignorant of how this works, then we just have to stumble about, and probably 80% of the time-ish, we're in a habitual reaction. We're in a habit pattern that's just playing out another time the way it has a million times before. Our perspective has a lot to do with how we translate our experiences. So probably a lot of people in this room, it's like, well, when I heard about Buddhism, I got really interested because suddenly I became aware that there might be a different way to see things in my life. So why do we get caught on the wheel? Well, it moves really fast. Oftentimes we're ignorant. And because we take everything personally, and that adds a lot of weight. I think probably we can all relate to that. I think we've been feeling some of that. It's been troubling to see the suffering in the world, to see our own suffering around things changing in the world. We have very personal experiences of that. We have very strong whys and stories about that. In truth, nothing happens to us. It happens from us. So this kicking into the craving part, going from feeling to craving, is where we want to see especially how that works. And right effort, which is one of the Eightfold Path, it's a part of the wisdom component, which includes mindfulness and meditation. I just lost myself there. Where did I start? Right effort? Mm-hmm. Oh. Right effort. Something. Right effort. Ah, right effort. Back to right effort. So right effort is when I find that I'm doing something unwholesome. So I'm probably someplace in that craving, clinging, habitual tendency part, then stop. And if a good choice at that point is, so release that, relax, so that I can experience the release of craving, and choose a wholesome act. And it turns out, this talk really comes from some of the studying I've been doing. So it really doesn't come from me. It comes from the teachers of the studying that I've been doing. So the recommendation I've been receiving is smile. Turn up the corners of your mouth. Physically, that actually changes. There's a whole chain of reaction to smiling. I will give you, or you can go Google, TED Talk smiling. 7 minutes. The biology, the proof, the experimentation is quite powerful. So it's like, well, and it doesn't really matter if you don't feel like smiling. The human body is built in such a way that just turning up the corners of the mouth, you know all those pictures of the Buddha with the corners of his mouth turned up, you can smile. So I've been following that recommendation, and I have to tell you, I'm a believer, right? I'm an experiencer of that helps, you know. So remembering to smile when I'm first wake up makes a big difference. Remember to smile every time I notice that I'm someplace else during the day or someplace else in my meditation. So though that's part of right effort. The other part is to cultivate the conditions that give rise to strengthening and continuation of the wholesome, and to abandon that which gives rise to suffering. Now that's really the hard part, right? Particularly because it's personal. It doesn't seem like my own personal experience of it is, but who will I be? How will the world be if there's not me as I know me in it, with all of my likes and dislikes? So that's a big piece, being willing. That's part of, and this process of observing dependent origination and that chain again and again and again and again is to help us really penetrate all those elements, appearance, disappearance, dangers, gratification, escape. When we start seeing that, and particularly in a time like this for me, when I start seeing that, it's like, how valuable is it for you to hang on to this idea of personal, like, I want to make a difference. I want to have a meaningful life. It's like, if I'm letting go of this I, am I really willing to experiment with that piece of abandonment, of renunciation? Is it really more important than the suffering that I'm witnessing? Is it really true that I couldn't stand to do something differently? Let's keep going. So this is the process that I've been working with based on the teachers that I've been listening to. And they're Vipassana tradition teachers. So this is a very simple way of doing a meditation, but also moving through the day in activity. And that is first the recognition that there's tension in the body for the most part. Being able to recognize, usually after the fact, but gradually as we work on this, as we train the mind, we can start seeing it even before it gets to the craving stage, while it's still in the contact or feeling stage. We can see the red flag. It's like, ooh. Sometimes there's a phrase or a trigger or a person or a situation where we know there's going to be difficulty. There's going to be a craving pattern. So releasing it. Now, one of the things that I find I have a personal reaction to is the words let go or accept everything. What comes up for me is I can't. I'm really mad at you for suggesting I should do that, because if I can't do that, then that means I have to suffer, and I really don't want to suffer, so go away and stop talking to me. I think I'll read a book. I'll take a walk and not think about this. But the release doesn't have to be that involved. I think a picture that's helpful for me is just opening the hand. Just release it. It doesn't necessarily, it's going to hang out probably for a while too. It's just, oh, no, I just have to open my hand and shift to relax so that I can get the full experience of letting go of that craving part. And then oftentimes it doesn't take much thinking to smile because there's relief there. So, and then the effort is to return to your object of meditation. Now, the teachers I've been getting this, and it's Venerable Bhante Vimala Ramsi, or Bhante V, calls this the six R's: recognize, release, relax, re-smile, return, and repeat. So whenever I notice this tension, whenever I notice any part of the personal chain, I can simply release, open that hand. And then I return to metta, is what he suggests. So the object becomes just radiating loving kindness. Well, how do I do that? I can get a chest pain trying to radiate. And the problem there, of course, is I'm craving, right? So it's just sort of like I'm trying to do it right. I'm trying to get rid of it. Oh, there it is again, craving. Little smile, relax the body, return. And just wishing myself, and he likes to recommend that you focus on a spiritual friend and send them. But you have to kind of restart your meditation again. And there will be, this was an interesting thing for me because I didn't really think of it this way. I usually skip from notice to, you know, whack back to meditation object. There's not a smile. There's not a relax. And there's really not a release, right? There's no direct experience of the cessation of suffering. It's just get to work, right? And so this process has changed that a little bit. And being able to notice that the thought or the craving, it doesn't even have to be all gone for me to still be essentially aware of my meditation object. I can see, you know, it's kind of like, you know, poking. It's like a nagging child or something like that. But I want it, you know. Smile, release, relax. May all beings, including me, be content. I've been noticing my reaction to content, which is I get a little restless immediately upon the whole idea that I would just be content. So this is very useful information, right? It's impersonal. It's just the way things work in this particular human body. And that allows me to begin to appreciate the value of impersonal perspective. So the impersonal perspective is essentially letting things be as they are. Now, as we contemplate the current environment, a lot of us are just automatically repelled, outraged. I mean, there's just a huge reaction there. So for me, and I'm offering to you whatever you're willing to take up, it's helpful to have this process, to try out just realizing this is just what's happening. It's just what's happening. And the things that I can abandon are ignorance, craving, clinging, habit tendencies, and the birth of reactions. Those I have some choice around. What we still live with is all the things that create things all the way down to contact and feeling that are unpleasant as well as pleasant, or neither. So oftentimes, we don't remember that at the same time that in the news or from our friends that we're hearing about suffering, violence, things that enrage us, that we don't have the whole picture, and that at the same time that that's happening, there's a moon, there's stars, there's people taking care of children, there's people taking care of each other, there's love, there's friendship, there's teamwork, there's sanghas. All of that's happening at the very same time. All of that's part of the deal. We don't have any choice. And it's not personal. It's not personal. That's the hard part. It's like, how can that be true? So my last injunction at 12:10:24. Oh. So this is a summary. Craving in mind and body manifests as tension and tightness. as I don't like it or I do like it. And clinging manifests as a story about why. So that's the involvement part. Tension triggers the habitual reactions. Habitual reactions turn the wheel. In the meditation of life, remember the six R's. Recognize, release, relax, re-smile, return. Repeat as necessary, which means all the time. Letting go of tension is letting go of craving and clinging. That's an important experience for us to be present for because it is our direct experience of the cessation of suffering. And I want to make sure that I recognize the Venerable Khante Khema, who is on YouTube. This talk name is Impersonal Perspective in You. I'm going to try when this talk is posted to include some links for people. And we have people outside. Okay. All right.
But it's not personal.
That's my final word.
The closing chant is on the front of the bulletin. May our intentions equally penetrate every being and place with the merit of Buddha's word.